The king, upon hearing that Krishna and Balaram had come and were eager to witness his daughter's wedding, went forth with abundant offerings to greet them as music resounded. Presenting them with Madhuparka, new clothing, and other desirable gifts, he worshipped them according to standard rituals. Generous King Bhishmika arranged opulent accommodations for the two lords, and also for their army and entourage. In this way, he afforded them proper hospitality. Thus it was that Bhishmika gave all desirable things to the kings who had assembled for the occasion, honoring them as befitted their political power, age, physical prowess, and wealth. When the residents of Vidarbhapur heard that Lord Krishna had come, they all went to see him. With the cupped palms of their eyes, they drank the honey of his lotus face. The people of the city said, Rukmini and no one else deserves to become his wife, and he also, possessing such flawless beauty, is the only suitable husband for the princess. May Achyuta, the creator of the three worlds, be satisfied with whatever pious work we may have done and show his mercy by taking the hand of Vaidarbhi. Bound by their swelling love, the city's residents spoke in this way. Then the bride, protected by guards, left the inner palace to visit the temple of Ambika. Rukmini silently went out on foot to see the lotus feet of the deity Bhavani. Accompanied by her mothers and girlfriends and protected by the king's valiant soldiers who held their upraised weapons at the ready, she simply absorbed her mind in the lotus feet of Krishna. And all the wild mridangas, conch shells, panavas, horns, and other instruments resounded. Behind the bride followed thousands of prominent courtesans bearing various offerings and presents, along with well-adorned Brahmins' wives singing and reciting prayers and bearing gifts of garlands, scents, clothing, and jewelry. There were also professional singers, musicians, bards, chroniclers, and heralds. Upon reaching the goddess's temple, Rukmini first washed her lotus feet and hands and then sipped water for purification. Thus sanctified and peaceful, she came into the presence of Mother Ambika. The older wives of Brahmins, expert in the knowledge of rituals, led young Rukmini in offering respects to Bhavani, who appeared with her consort, Lord Shiva. Princess Rukmini prayed, O Mother Ambika, wife of Lord Shiva, I repeatedly offer my obeisances unto you, together with your children. May Lord Krishna become my husband. Please grant this. Rukmini worshipped the goddess with water, scents, whole grains, incense, clothing, garlands, necklaces, jewelry, and other prescribed offerings and gifts, and also with arrays of lamps. The married Brahmin women each performed worship simultaneously with the same items, also offering savories and cakes, prepared betel nut, sacred threads, fruit, and sugarcane juice. The ladies gave the bride the remnants of the offerings and then blessed her. She, in turn, bowed down to them and the deity and accepted the remnants of prasadam. The princess then gave up her vow of silence and left the Ambika temple, holding on to a maidservant with her hand, which was adorned with a jeweled ring. Rukmini appeared as enchanting as the Lord's illusory potency, who enchants even the sober and grave. Thus the kings gazed upon her virgin beauty, her shapely waist, and her lovely face adorned with earrings. Her hips were graced with a jewel-studded belt, her breasts were just budding, and her eyes seemed apprehensive of her encroaching locks of hair. She smiled sweetly, her jasmine bud teeth reflecting the glow of her bimber-red lips. As she walked with the motions of a royal swan, the effulgence of her tinkling ankle bells beautified her feet. Seeing her, the assembled heroes were totally bewildered. Lust tore at their hearts. Indeed, when the king saw her broad smile and shy glance, they became stupefied, dropped their weapons, and fell unconscious to the ground from their elephants, chariots, and horses. On the pretext of the procession, Rukmini displayed her beauty for Krishna alone. Slowly she advanced the two moving lotus whorls of her feet, awaiting the arrival of the Supreme Lord. With the fingernails of her left hand, she pushed some strands of hair away from her face and shyly looked from the corners of her eyes at the king standing before her. At that moment, she saw Krishna. Then, while his enemies looked on, the Lord seized the princess, who was eager to mount his chariot. Lifting the princess onto his chariot, whose flag bore the emblem of Garuda, Lord Madhava drove back the circle of kings. With Balaram in the lead, he slowly exited, like a lion removing his prey from the midst of jackals. The kings inimical to the Lord, headed by Jarasandh, could not tolerate this humiliating defeat. They exclaimed, "Oh, damn us! Though we are mighty archers, mere cowherds have stolen our honor, just as puny animals might steal the honor of lions." Chapter 54, The Marriage of Krishna and Rukmini. Shukadev Goswami said, "Having thus spoken, all those infuriated kings donned their armor and mounted their conveyances. Each king, bow in hand, was surrounded by his own army as he went after Lord Krishna. The commanders of the Yadava army, seeing the enemy racing to attack, turned to face them and stood firm, O king, twanging their bows. Mounted on the backs of horses, the shoulders of elephants, and the seats of chariots, the enemy kings, expert with weapons, rained down arrows upon the Yadus like clouds pouring rain on mountains. Slender-waisted Rukmini, seeing her lord's army covered by torrents of arrows, shyly looked at his face with fear-stricken eyes. In response, the lord laughed and assured her, "Do not be afraid, beautiful-eyed one. This enemy force is about to be destroyed by your soldiers." The heroes of the lord's army, headed by Gada and Sankarshan, could not tolerate the aggression of the opposing kings. Thus, with iron arrows, they began to strike down the enemy's horses, elephants, and chariots. The heads of soldiers fighting on chariots, horses, and elephants fell to the ground by the millions. Some heads wore earrings and helmets, others turbans. Lying all around were thighs, legs, and fingerless hands, along with hands clutching swords, clubs, and bows, and also the heads of horses, donkeys, elephants, camels, wild asses, and humans. Seeing their armies being struck down by the Vrishnis, who were eager for victory, the kings headed by Jarasandh were discouraged and left the battlefield. The kings approached Shishupal, who was disturbed like a man who has lost his wife. His complexion was drained of color, his enthusiasm was gone, and his face appeared dried up. The king spoke to him as follows. Jarasandh said, "Listen, Shishupal, O tiger among men, give up your depression. After all, embodied beings' happiness and unhappiness is never seen to be permanent, O king. Just as a puppet in the form of a woman dances by the desire of the puppeteer, so this world, controlled by the Supreme Lord, struggles in both happiness and misery. In battle with Krishna, I and my 23 armies lost 17 times. Only once did I defeat him. But still, I never lament or rejoice, because I know this world is driven by time and fate. And now all of us, great commanders of military leaders, have been defeated by the Yadus and their small entourage, who are protected by Krishna. Now our enemies have conquered because time favors them. But in the future, when time is auspicious for us, we shall conquer." Shukadev Goswami said, thus persuaded by his friends, Shishupal took his followers and went back to his capital. The surviving warriors also returned to their respective cities. Powerful Rukmi, however, was especially envious of Krishna. He could not bear the fact that Krishna had carried off his sister to marry her in the Rakshasa style. Thus he pursued the Lord with an entire military division. Frustrated and enraged, mighty-armed Rukmi, dressed in armor and wielding his bow, had sworn before all the kings, "I shall not again enter Kundina if I do not kill Krishna in battle and bring Rukmini back with me. I swear this to you." Having said this, he had mounted his chariot and told his charioteer, "Drive the horses quickly to where Krishna is. He and I must fight. This wicked-minded cowherd boy, infatuated with his prowess, has violently abducted my sister. But today I will remove his pride with my sharp arrows." Boasting thus, foolish Rukmi, ignorant of the true extent of the Supreme Lord's power, approached Lord Govinda in his lone chariot and challenged him, "Just stand and fight." Rukmi drew his bow with great strength and struck Lord Krishna with three arrows. Then he said, "Stand here for a moment, O defiler of the Yadu dynasty. Wherever you go, carrying off my sister like a crow stealing sacrificial butter, I will follow. This very day I shall relieve you of your false pride, you fool, you deceiver, you cheater in battle." Release the girl before you are struck dead by my arrows and made to lie down. In response to this, Lord Krishna smiled, and with six arrows he struck Rukmi and broke his bow. The Lord struck Rukmi's four horses with eight arrows, his chariot driver with two, and the chariot's flag with three. Rukmi grabbed another bow and struck Lord Krishna with five arrows. Seeing Lord Krishna ready to kill her brother, saintly Rukmini was filled with alarm. She fell at her husband's feet and piteously spoke as follows. O controller of all mystic power, immeasurable one, Lord of lords, master of the universe, O all auspicious and mighty armed Lord, please do not kill my brother. Shukadev Goswami said, Rukmini's utter fear caused her limbs to tremble and her mouth to dry up, while her throat choked up out of sorrow. And in her agitation, her golden necklace scattered. She grasped Krishna's feet, and the Lord, feeling compassionate, desisted. Lord Krishna tied up the evildoer with a strip of cloth. He then proceeded to disfigure Rukmi by comically shaving him, leaving parts of his mustache and hair. By that time, the Yadu heroes had crushed the extraordinary army of their opponents, just as elephants crush a lotus flower. As the Yadus approached Lord Krishna, they saw Rukmi in this sorry condition, practically dying of shame. When the all-powerful Lord Balaram saw Rukmi, he compassionately released him and spoke the following to Lord Krishna. My dear Krishna, you have acted improperly. This deed will bring shame on us, for to disfigure a close relative by shaving off his mustache and hair is as good as killing him. Saintly lady, please do not be displeased with us out of anxiety for your brother's disfigurement. No one but oneself is responsible for one's joy and grief, for a man experiences the result of his own deeds. Again addressing Krishna, Balaram said, A relative should not be killed even if his wrongdoing warrants capital punishment. Rather, he should be thrown out of the family. Since he has already been killed by his own sin, why kill him again? Turning to Rukmini, Balaram continued, The code of sacred duty for warriors established by Lord Brahma enjoins that one may have to kill even his own brother. That is indeed a most dreadful law. Again, Balaram addressed Krishna. Blinded by conceit with their personal opulences, proud men offend others for the sake of such things as kingdom, land, wealth, women, honor, and power. To Rukmini, Balaram said, Your attitude is unfair. For, like an ignorant person, you wish good to those who are inimical to all living beings and who have done evil to your true well-wishers. The Supreme Lord's Maya makes men forget their real selves, and thus, taking the body for the self, they consider others to be friends, enemies, or neutral parties. Those who are bewildered perceive the one Supreme Soul, who resides in all embodied beings, as many, just as one may perceive the light in the sky or the sky itself as many. This material body, which has a beginning and an end, is composed of the physical elements, the senses, and the modes of nature. The body, imposed on the self by material ignorance, causes one to experience the cycle of birth and death. O intelligent lady, the soul never undergoes contact with or separation from insubstantial material objects, because the soul is their very origin and illuminator. Thus the soul resembles the sun, which neither comes in contact with nor separates from the sense of sight and what is seen. Birth and other transformations are undergone by the body, but never by the self, just as change occurs for the moon's phases, but never for the moon, though the new moon day may be called the moon's death. As a sleeping person perceives himself, the objects of sense enjoyment, and the fruits of his acts within the illusion of a dream, so one who is unintelligent undergoes material existence. Therefore, with transcendental knowledge, dispel the grief that is weakening and confounding your mind. Please resume your natural mood, O Princess of the Pristine Smile. Shukadev Goswami said, Thus enlightened by Lord Balaram, slender Rukmini forgot her depression and steadied her mind by spiritual intelligence. Left with only his life air, cast out by his enemies, and deprived of his strength and bodily radiance, Rukmi could not forget how he had been disfigured. In frustration, he constructed for his residence a large city, which he called Bhojakata. Because he had promised, I will not re-enter Kundina until I have killed wicked Krishna and brought back my younger sister. In a mood of angry frustration, Rukmi took up residence at that very place. Thus, defeating all the opposing kings, the Supreme Personality of Godhead brought the daughter of Bhishmaka to his capital and married her according to the Vedic injunctions, O protector of the Kurus. At that time, there was great rejoicing in all the homes of Yadupuri, whose citizens loved only Krishna, chief of the Yadus. All the men and women, full of joy and adorned with shining jewels and earrings, brought wedding presents, which they reverently offered to the exquisitely dressed groom and bride. The city of the Vrishnis appeared most beautiful. There were tall, festive columns, and also archways decorated with flower garlands, cloth banners, and precious gems. Arrangements of auspicious, full water pots, a guru-scented incense, and lamps graced every doorway. The city's streets were cleansed by the intoxicated elephants belonging to the beloved kings who were guests at the wedding. And these elephants further enhanced the beauty of the city by placing trunks of plantain and betel nut trees in all the doorways. Those who belonged to the royal families of the Kuru, Srinjaya, Kaikeya, Vidarbha, Yadu, and Kunti clans joyfully met one another in the midst of the crowds of people excitedly running here and there. The kings and their daughters were totally astonished to hear the story of Rukmini's abduction, which was being glorified in song everywhere. Dwaraka's citizens were overjoyed to see Krishna, the lord of all opulence, united with Rukmini, the goddess of fortune. Chapter 55, The History of Pradyumna. Shukadev Goswami said, Kamadev, Cupid, an expansion of Vasudev, had previously been burned to ashes by Rudra's anger. Now, to obtain a new body, he merged back into the body of Lord Vasudev. He took birth in the womb of Vaidarbhi from the seed of Lord Krishna and received the name Pradyumna. In no respect was he inferior to his father. The demon Shambhara, who could assume any form he desired, kidnapped the infant before he was even 10 days old. Understanding Pradyumna to be his enemy, Shambhara threw him into the sea and then returned home. A powerful fish swallowed Pradyumna, and this fish, along with others, was caught in a huge net and seized by fishermen. The fishermen presented that extraordinary fish to Shambhara, who had his cooks bring it to the kitchen, where they began cutting it up with a butcher knife. Seeing a male child in the belly of the fish, the cooks gave the infant to Mayavati, who was astonished. Narada Muni then appeared and explained to her everything about the child's birth and his entering the fish's abdomen. Mayavati was in fact Cupid's renowned wife, Rati. While waiting for her husband to obtain a new body, his previous one having been burnt up, she had been assigned by Shambhara to prepare vegetables and rice. Mayavati understood that this infant was actually Kamadev, and thus she began to feel love for him. After a short time, this son of Krishna, Pradyumna, attained his full youth. He enchanted all women who gazed upon him. My dear king, with a bashful smile and raised eyebrows, Mayavati exhibited various gestures of conjugal attraction as she lovingly approached her husband, whose eyes were broad like the petals of a lotus, whose arms were very long, and who was the most beautiful of men. Lord Pradyumna told her, "Oh, mother, your attitude has changed. You are overstepping the proper feelings of a mother and behaving like a lover." Rati said, "You are the son of Lord Narayan and were kidnapped from your parents' home by Shambhara. I, Rati, am your legitimate wife, O master, because you are Cupid. That demon, Shambhara, threw you into the sea when you were not even 10 days old, and a fish swallowed you. Then in this very place we recovered you from the fish's abdomen, O master. Now kill this dreadful Shambhara, your formidable enemy. Although he knows hundreds of magic spells, you can defeat him with bewildering magic and other techniques. Your poor mother, having lost her son, cries for you like a kurari bird. She is overwhelmed with love for her child, just like a cow that has lost its calf." Shukadev Goswami continued, "Speaking thus, Mayavati gave to the great soul Pradyumna the mystic knowledge called Mahamaya, which vanquishes all other deluding spells. Pradyumna approached Shambhara and called him to battle, hurling intolerable insults at him to foment a conflict. Offended by these harsh words, Shambhara became as agitated as a kicked snake. He came out, club in hand, his eyes red with rage. Shambhara whirled his club swiftly about and then hurled it at the wise Pradyumna, producing a sound as sharp as a thunder crack. As Shambhara's club came flying toward him, Lord Pradyumna knocked it away with his own. Then Pradyumna angrily threw his club at the enemy. Resorting to the black magic of the Daityas taught to him by Mayadhanava, Shambhara suddenly appeared in the sky and released a downpour of weapons upon Krishna's son. Harassed by this rain of weapons, Lord Pradyumna, the greatly powerful warrior, made use of the mystic science called Mahamaya, which was created from the mode of goodness and which could defeat all other mystic power. The demon then unleashed hundreds of mystic weapons belonging to the Guhyakas, Gandharvas, Pishachas, Urugas, and Rakshasas, but Lord Pradyumna struck them all down. Drawing his sharp-edged sword, Pradyumna forcefully cut off Shambhara's head, complete with red mustache, helmet, and earrings. As the residents of the higher planets showered Pradyumna with flowers and chanted his praises, his wife appeared in the sky and transported him through the heavens back to the city of Dwaraka. O King, Lord Pradyumna and his wife resembled a cloud accompanied by lightning as they descended from the sky into the inner quarters of Krishna's most excellent palace, which were crowded with lovely women. The women of the palace thought he was Lord Krishna when they saw his dark blue complexion, the color of a rain cloud, his yellow silk garments, his long arms and red-tinged eyes, his charming lotus face adorned with a pleasing smile, his fine ornaments, and his thick, curly blue hair. Thus the women became bashful and hid themselves here and there. Gradually, from the slight difference between his appearance and Krishna's, the ladies realized he was not the Lord. Delighted and astonished, they approached Pradyumna and his consort, who was a jewel among women. Seeing Pradyumna, sweet-voiced, dark-eyed Rukmani remembered her lost son, and her breasts became moist out of affection. Rukmani said, "Who is this lotus-eyed jewel among men? What man's son is he? And what woman carried him in her womb? And who is this woman he has taken as his wife? If my lost son, who was kidnapped from the maternity room, was still alive somewhere, he would be of the same age and appearance as this young man. But how is it that this young man so much resembles my own lord, Krishna, the wielder of Sharanga, in his bodily form and his limbs, in his gait and the tone of his voice, and in his smiling glance? Yes, he must be the same child I bore in my womb, since I feel great affection for him, and my left arm is quivering." As Queen Rukmini conjectured in this way, Lord Krishna, the son of Devaki, arrived on the scene with Vasudev and Devaki. Although Lord Janardhan knew perfectly well what had transpired, he remained silent. The sage Narada, however, explained everything, beginning with Shambhara's kidnapping of the child. When the women of Lord Krishna's palace heard this most amazing account, they joyfully greeted Pradyumna, who had been lost for many years, but who had now returned as if from the dead. Devaki, Vasudev, Krishna, Balaram, and all the women of the palace, especially Queen Rukmini, embraced the young couple and rejoiced. Hearing that lost Pradyumna had come home, the residents of Dwaraka declared, "Ah, Providence has allowed this child to return as if from death." It is not astonishing that the palace women, who should have felt maternal affection for Pradyumna, privately felt ecstatic attraction for him as if he were their own lord. After all, the son exactly resembled his father. Indeed, Pradyumna was a perfect reflection of the beauty of Lord Krishna, the shelter of the goddess of fortune, and appeared before their eyes as Cupid himself. Since even those on the level of his mother felt conjugal attraction for him, then what to speak of how other women felt when they saw him? Chapter 56, The Syamantaka Jewel. Shukadev Goswami said, "Having offended Lord Krishna, Satrajit tried as best he could to atone by presenting him with his daughter and the Syamantaka jewel." Maharaj Parikshit inquired, "O Brahman, what did King Satrajit do to offend Lord Krishna? Where did he get the Syamantaka jewel, and why did he give his daughter to the Supreme Lord?" Shukadev Goswami said, "Surya, the sun god, felt great affection for his devotee Satrajit. Acting as his greatest friend, the demigod gave him the jewel called Syamantaka as a token of his satisfaction. Wearing the jewel on his neck, Satrajit entered Dwaraka. He shone as brightly as the sun itself, O king, and thus he went unrecognized because of the jewel's effulgence. As the people looked at Satrajit from a distance, his brilliance blinded them. They presumed he was the sun god, Surya, and went to tell Lord Krishna, who was at that time playing a dice. The residents of Dwaraka said, "Obeisances unto you, O Narayan, O holder of the conch, disc, and club, O lotus-eyed Damodar, O Govinda, O cherished descendant of Yadu. Lord Surya has come to see you, O Lord of the universe. He is blinding everyone's eyes with his intensely effulgent rays. The most exalted demigods in the three worlds are certainly anxious to seek you out, O Lord, now that you have hidden yourself among the Yadu dynasty. Thus the unborn sun god has come to see you here." Shukadev Goswami continued, "Hearing these innocent words, the lotus-eyed lord smiled broadly and said, 'This is not the sun god, Ravi, but rather Satrajit, who is glowing because of his jewel.' King Satrajit entered his opulent home, festively executing auspicious rituals. He had qualified Brahmins install the Simantika jewel in the house's temple room. Each day the gem would produce 8 bars of gold, my dear Prabhu, and the place in which it was kept and properly worshipped would be free of calamities such as famine or untimely death, and also of evils like snake bites, mental and physical disorders, and the presence of deceitful persons." On one occasion, Lord Krishna requested Satrajit to give the jewel to the Yadu king, Ugrasen, but Satrajit was so greedy that he refused. He gave no thought to the seriousness of the offense he committed by denying the Lord's request. Once, Satrajit's brother, Prasena, having hung the brilliant jewel around his neck, mounted a horse and went hunting in the forest. A lion killed Prasena and his horse and took the jewel. But when the lion entered a mountain cave, he was killed by Jambavan, who wanted the jewel. Within the cave, Jambavan let his young son have the Simantika jewel as a toy to play with. Meanwhile, Satrajit, not seeing his brother return, became deeply troubled. He said, "Krishna probably killed my brother, who went to the forest wearing the jewel on his neck." The general populace heard this accusation and began whispering it in one another's ears. When Lord Krishna heard this rumor, he wanted to remove the stain on his reputation. So he took some of Dwaraka's citizens with him and set out to retrace Prasena's path. In the forest, they found Prasena and his horse both killed by the lion. Further on, they found the lion dead on a mountainside, slain by Jambavan. The Lord stationed his subjects outside the terrifying pitch-dark cave of the King of the Bears, and then he entered alone. There, Lord Krishna saw that the most precious of jewels had been made into a child's plaything. Determined to take it away, he approached the child. The child's nurse cried out in fear upon seeing that extraordinary person standing before them. Jambavan, strongest of the strong, heard her cries and angrily ran toward the Lord. Unaware of his true position and thinking him an ordinary man, Jambavan angrily began fighting with the Supreme Lord, his master. The two fought furiously in single combat, each determined to win. Contending against each other with various weapons and then with stones, tree trunks, and finally their bare arms, they struggled like two hawks battling over a piece of flesh. The fight went on without rest for 28 days, the two opponents striking each other with their fists, which fell like the cracking blows of lightning. His bulging muscles pummeled by the blows of Lord Krishna's fists, his strength faltering and his limbs perspiring, Jambavan, greatly astonished, finally spoke to the Lord. "I know now that you are the life air and the sensory, mental, and bodily strength of all living beings. You are Lord Vishnu, the original person, the supreme, all-powerful controller. You are the ultimate creator of all creators of the universe, and of everything created, you are the underlying substance. You are the subduer of all subduers, the supreme lord and supreme soul of all souls. You are he who impelled the ocean to give way when his sidelong glances, slightly manifesting his anger, disturbed the crocodiles and timangila fish within the watery depths. You are he who built a great bridge to establish his fame, who burned down the city of Lanka, and whose arrows severed the heads of Ravana, which then fell to the ground." Shukadev Goswami continued, "O King, Lord Krishna then addressed the King of the Bears, who had understood the truth. The lotus-eyed personality of Godhead, the son of Devaki, touched Jambavan with his hand, which bestows all blessings, and spoke to his devotee with sublime compassion, his grave voice deeply resounding like a cloud. Lord Krishna said, "It is for this jewel, O Lord of the Bears, that we have come to your cave. I intend to use the jewel to disprove the false accusations against me." Thus addressed, Jambavan happily honored Lord Krishna by offering him his maiden daughter, Jambavati, together with the jewel. After Lord Krishna had entered the cave, the people of Dwaraka who had accompanied him had waited 12 days without seeing him come out again. Finally, they had given up and returned to their city in great sorrow. When Devaki, Rukmini Devi, Vasudev, and the Lord's other relatives and friends heard that he had not come out of the cave, they all lamented. Cursing Satrajit, the sorrowful residents of Dwaraka approached the Durga deity named Chandrabhaga and prayed to her for Krishna's return. When the citizens had finished worshipping the demigoddess, she spoke to them in response, promising to grant their request. Just then, Lord Krishna, who had achieved his purpose, appeared before them in the company of his new wife, filling them with joy. Seeing Lord Rishikesh return as if from death, accompanied by his new wife and wearing the Simantaka jewel on his neck, all the people were roused to jubilation. Lord Krishna summoned Satrajit to the royal assembly. There, in the presence of King Ugrasen, Krishna announced the recovery of the jewel and then formally presented it to Satrajit. Hanging his head in great shame, Satrajit took the gem and returned home, all the while feeling remorse for his sinful behavior. Pondering over his grievous offense and wondering about the possibility of conflict with the Lord's mighty devotees, King Satrajit thought, "How can I cleanse myself of my contamination? And how may Lord Achyuta become satisfied with me? What can I do to regain my good fortune and avoid being cursed by the populace for being so short-sighted, miserly, foolish, and avaricious? I shall give my daughter, the jewel of all women, to the Lord, together with the Simantaka jewel. That indeed is the only proper way to pacify him." Having thus intelligently made up his mind, King Satrajit personally arranged to present Lord Krishna with his fair daughter and the Simantaka jewel. The Lord married Satyabhama in proper religious fashion. Possessed of excellent behavior, along with beauty, broad-mindedness, and all other good qualities, she had been sought by many men. The Supreme Personality of Godhead told Satrajit, "We do not care to take this jewel back, O King. You are the sun god's devotee, so let it stay in your possession. Thus we will also enjoy its benefits." Chapter 57, Satrajit Murdered, the Jewel Returned. Sri Badarayani said, "Although Lord Govinda was fully aware of what had actually occurred, when he heard reports that the Pandavas and Queen Kunti had been burned to death, he went with Lord Balaram to the kingdom of the Kurus to fulfill the family obligations expected of him. The two lords met with Bhishma, Kripa, Vidura, Gandhari, and Drona. Showing sorrow equal to theirs, they cried out, 'Alas, how painful this is!' Taking advantage of this opportunity, O King, Akura and Kritavarma went to Shatadanva and said, 'Why not take the Simantaka jewel? Satrajit promised his jewel-like daughter to us, but then gave her to Krishna instead, contemptuously neglecting us. So why should Satrajit not follow his brother's path?' His mind thus influenced by their advice, wicked Shatadanva murdered Satrajit in his sleep simply out of greed. In this way, the sinful Shatadanva shortened his own lifespan. As the women of Satrajit's palace screamed and helplessly wept, Shatadanva took the jewel and left, like a butcher after he has killed some animals. When Satyabhama saw her dead father, she was plunged into grief, lamenting, "My father, my father! Oh, I am killed!" She fell unconscious. Queen Satyabhama put her father's corpse in a large vat of oil and went to Hastinapur, where she sorrowfully told Lord Krishna, who was already aware of the situation, about her father's murder. When Lord Krishna and Lord Balaram heard this news, they exclaimed, "Alas, this is the greatest tragedy for us!" Thus imitating the ways of human society, they lamented, their eyes brimming with tears. The Supreme Lord returned to his capital with his wife and elder brother. After arriving in Dwarka, he readied himself to kill Shatadanva and retrieve the jewel from him. Upon learning that Lord Krishna was preparing to kill him, Shatadanva was struck with fear. To save his life, he approached Kritavarma and begged him for help, but Kritavarma replied as follows, "I dare not offend the Supreme Lords, Krishna and Balaram. Indeed, how can one who troubles them expect any good fortune? Kamsa and all his followers lost both their wealth and their lives because of enmity toward them. And after battling them 17 times, Jarasandh was left without even a chariot." His appeal refused. Shatadanva went to Akrura and begged him for protection. But Akrura similarly told him, "Who would oppose the two personalities of Godhead if he knew their strength? It is the Supreme Lord who creates, maintains, and destroys this universe simply as his pastime. The cosmic creators cannot even understand his purpose, bewildered as they are by his illusory maya. As a child of 7, Krishna uprooted an entire mountain and held it aloft as easily as a young boy picks up a mushroom. I offer my obeisances to that supreme personality of Godhead, Krishna, whose every deed is amazing. He is the supreme soul, the unlimited source and fixed center of all existence." His appeal thus rejected by Akrura also, Shatadanva placed the precious jewel in Akrura's care and fled on a horse that could travel 800 miles. "My dear king, Krishna and Balaram mounted Krishna's chariot, which flew the flag of Garuda and was yoked with tremendously swift horses, and pursued their elder's murderer. In a garden on the outskirts of Mithila, the horse Shatadanva was riding collapsed. Terrified, he abandoned the horse and began to flee on foot, with Krishna in angry pursuit. As Shatadanva fled on foot, the Supreme Lord, also going on foot, cut off his head with his sharp-edged disc. The Lord then searched Shatadanva's upper and lower garments for the Syamantaka jewel. Not finding the jewel, Lord Krishna went to his elder brother and said, 'We have killed Shatadanva uselessly. The jewel isn't here.' To this, Lord Balaram replied, 'Indeed, Shatadanva must have placed the jewel in the care of someone. We should return to our city and find that person. I wish to visit King Videha, who is most dear to me.' O king, having said this, Lord Balaram, the beloved descendant of Yadu, entered the city of Mithila. The king of Mithila immediately rose from his seat when he saw Lord Balaram approaching. With great love, the king honored the supremely worshipable Lord by offering him elaborate worship as stipulated by scriptural injunctions. The almighty Lord Balaram stayed in Mithila for several years, honored by his affectionate devotee, Janaka Maharaj. During that time, Dhritarashtra's son, Duryodhana, learned from Balaram the art of fighting with a club. Lord Keshava arrived in Dwarka and described the demise of Shatadanva and his own failure to find the Syamantaka jewel. He spoke in a way that would please his beloved, Satyabhama. Lord Krishna then had the various funeral rites performed for his deceased relative, Satrajit. The Lord attended the funeral along with well-wishers of the family. When Akrura and Kritavarma, who had originally incited Shatadanva to commit his crime, heard that he had been killed, they fled Dwarka in terror and took up residence elsewhere. In Akrura's absence, ill omens arose in Dwarka, and the citizens began to suffer continually from physical and mental distresses, as well as from disturbances caused by higher powers and by creatures of the earth. Some men proposed that the troubles were due to Akrura's absence, but they had forgotten the glories of the Supreme Lord, which they themselves had so often described. Indeed, how can calamities occur in a place where the personality of Godhead, the residence of all the sages, resides? The elders said, "Previously, when Lord Indra had withheld rain from Kashi, the king of that city gave his daughter Gandini to Shapalka, who was then visiting him. It soon rained in the kingdom of Kashi. Wherever his equally powerful son Akrura stays, Lord Indra will provide sufficient rain. Indeed, that place will be free of miseries and untimely deaths." Hearing these words from the elders, Lord Janardhan, though aware that the absence of Akrura was not the only cause of the evil omens, had him summoned back to Dwarka and spoke to him. Lord Krishna honored Akrura, greeted him confidentially, and spoke pleasant words with him. Then the Lord, who was fully aware of Akrura's heart by virtue of his being the knower of everything, smiled and addressed him. O Master of Charity, surely the opulent Syamantakajula was left in your care by Shatadanva and is still with you. Indeed, we have known this all along. Since the Trajit had no sons, his daughter's sons should receive his inheritance. They should pay for memorial offerings of water and pinda, clear their grandfather's outstanding debts, and keep the remainder of the inheritance for themselves. Nevertheless, the jewel should remain in your care, O trustworthy Akrura, because no one else can keep it safely. But please show the jewel just once, since my elder brother does not fully believe what I have told him about it. In this way, O most fortunate one, you will pacify my relatives. Everyone knows you have the jewel, for you are now continually performing sacrifices on altars of gold. Thus shamed by Lord Krishna's conciliatory words, Akrura brought out the jewel from where he had concealed it in his clothing and gave it to the Lord. The brilliant gem shone like the sun. After the Almighty Lord had shown the Syamantaka jewel to his relatives, thus dispelling the false accusations against him, he returned it to Akrura. This narration, rich with descriptions of the prowess of Lord Sri Vishnu, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, removes sinful reactions and bestows all auspiciousness. Anyone who recites, hears, or remembers it will drive away his own infamy and sins and attain peace. Chapter 58. Krishna marries five princesses. Shukadev Goswami said, "Once the supremely opulent personality of Godhead went to Indraprastha to visit the Pandavas, who had again appeared in public. Accompanying the Lord were Yuyudhan and other associates. When the Pandavas saw that Lord Mukunda had arrived, those heroic sons of Prita all stood up at once, like the senses responding to the return of the life air. The heroes embraced Lord Achyuta, and the touch of his body freed them of sin. Looking at his affectionate, smiling face, they were overwhelmed with joy. After the Lord bowed down at the feet of Yudhishthir and Bhima and firmly embraced Arjuna, he accepted obeisances from the twin brothers, Nakula and Sahadev. Faultless Draupadi, the Pandava's newly married wife, slowly and somewhat timidly approached Lord Krishna, who sat on an exalted seat, and offered him her obeisances. Satyaki also accepted a seat of honor after receiving worship and welcome from the Pandavas, and the Lord's other companions, being duly honored, sat down in various places. The Lord then went to see his aunt, Queen Kunti. He bowed down to her and she embraced him, her eyes moist with great affection. Lord Krishna inquired from her and her daughter-in-law, Draupadi, about their welfare, and they in turn questioned him at length about his relatives in Dwaraka. So overcome by love that her throat choked up and her eyes filled with tears, Queen Kunti remembered the many troubles she and her sons had endured. Thus she addressed Lord Krishna, who appears before his devotees to drive away their distress. Queen Kunti said, "My dear Krishna, our welfare was assured only when you remembered us, your relatives, and gave us your protection by sending my brother to visit us. For you, the well-wishing friend and supreme soul of the universe, there is never any illusion of us and them. Yet even so, residing within the hearts of all, you eradicate the sufferings of those who remember you constantly." King Yudhishthir said, "O Supreme Controller, I do not know what pious deeds we fools have done so that we can see you, whom the masters of yogic perfection rarely see." Requested by the king to stay with them, the Almighty Lord remained happily in Indraprastha during the months of the rainy season, giving joy to the eyes of the city's residents. Once, Arjuna, the slayer of powerful enemies, donned his armor, mounted his chariot flying the flag of Hanuman, took up his bow and his two inexhaustible quivers, and went to sport with Lord Krishna in a large forest filled with fierce animals. With his arrows, Arjuna shot tigers, boars, and buffalo in that forest, along with rurus, sharabas, gavayas, rhinoceroses, black deer, rabbits, and porcupines. A crew of servants carried to King Yudhishthir the slain animals fit to be offered in sacrifice on some special occasion. Then, feeling thirsty and tired, Arjun went to the bank of the Yamuna. After Krishna and Arjun had bathed there, they drank the river's clear water. The great warriors then saw an attractive young girl walking nearby. Sent by Krishna, Arjun approached the exceptional young woman, who possessed beautiful hips, fine teeth, and a lovely face, and he inquired from her as follows. "Who are you, O fine waisted lady? Whose daughter are you, and where do you come from? What are you doing here? I think you must be looking for a husband. Please explain everything, O beautiful one." Sri Kalindi said, "I am the daughter of the sun god. I desire to get as my husband the most excellent and munificent Lord Vishnu, and to that end I am performing severe penances. I will accept no husband other than him, the abode of the goddess of fortune. May that Mukunda, the supreme personality, the shelter of the helpless, be pleased with me. I am known as Kalindi, and I live in a mansion my father built for me within the water of the Yamuna. There I will stay until I meet Lord Achyuta." Shukadeva Goswami continued, "Arjuna repeated all this to Lord Vasudev, who was already aware of it. The Lord then took Kalindi onto his chariot and went back to see King Yudhishthir." Describing a previous incident, Shukadeva Goswami said, "Upon the request of the Pandavas, Lord Krishna had Vishvakarma build them a most wonderful and amazing city. The Supreme Lord stayed in that city for some time to please his devotees. On one occasion, Sri Krishna wanted to give the Kandava forest as a gift to Agni, and so the Lord became Arjuna's charioteer. Being pleased, Lord Agni presented Arjuna with a bow, a set of white horses, a chariot, a pair of inexhaustible quivers, and armor that no fighter could pierce with weapons. When the demon Maya was saved from the fire by his friend Arjuna, Maya presented him with an assembly hall in which Duryodhana would later mistake water for a solid floor. Then Lord Krishna, given leave by Arjuna and other well-wishing relatives and friends, returned to Dwarka with Satyaki and the rest of his entourage. The supremely auspicious Lord then married Kalindi on a day when the season, the lunar asterism, and the configurations of the sun and other heavenly bodies were all propitious. In this way he brought the greatest pleasure to his devotees. Vindhya and Anuvindhya, who shared the throne of Avanti, were followers of Duryodhana's. When the time came for their sister Mitravinda to select her husband in the Swayamvara ceremony, they forbade her to choose Krishna, although she was attracted to him. My dear king, Lord Krishna forcibly took away Princess Mitravinda, the daughter of his aunt Rajadi Devi, before the eyes of the rival kings. Nagnajit, the very pious king of Kaushalya, had a lovely daughter named Satya, or Nagnajiti. The kings who came as suitors were not allowed to marry her unless they could subdue 7 sharp-horned bulls. These bulls were extremely vicious and uncontrollable, and they could not tolerate even the smell of warriors. When the Supreme Personality of Godhead, the master of the Vaishnavas, heard of the princess who was to be won by the conqueror of the bulls, he went to the capital of Kaushalya with a large army. The king of Kosala, pleased to see Lord Krishna, worshipped him by rising from his throne and offering him a seat of honor and substantial gifts. Lord Krishna also greeted the king respectfully. When the king's daughter saw that most agreeable suitor arrive, she immediately desired to have him, the lord of Goddess Rama. She prayed, "May he become my husband. If I have kept my vows, may the sacred fire bring about the fulfillment of my hopes. Goddess Lakshmi, Lord Brahma, Lord Shiva, and the rulers of the various planets place the dust of his lotus feet on their heads. And to protect the codes of religion which he has created, he assumes pastime incarnations at various times. How may that Supreme Personality of Godhead become pleased with me?" King Nagnajit first worshipped the Lord properly and then addressed him. "O Narayan, Lord of the universe, you are full in your own spiritual pleasure. Therefore, what can this insignificant person do for you?" Shukadeva Goswami said, "O beloved descendant of Kuru, the Supreme Lord was pleased, and after accepting a comfortable seat, he smiled and addressed the king in a voice as deep as the rumbling of a cloud. the Supreme Lord said, O ruler of men, learned authorities condemn begging for a person in the royal order who is executing his religious duties. Even so, desiring your friendship, I ask you for your daughter, though we offer no gifts in exchange. The king said, My lord, who could be a better husband for my daughter than you, the exclusive abode of all transcendental qualities? On your body the goddess of fortune herself resides, never leaving you for any reason. But to ascertain the proper husband for my daughter, we previously set a condition to test the prowess of her suitors. These 7 wild bulls are impossible to tame, O hero. They have defeated many princes, breaking their limbs. If you can subdue them, O descendant of Yadu, you will certainly be the appropriate bridegroom for my daughter. Upon hearing these terms, the Lord tightened his clothing, expanded himself into 7 forms, and easily subdued the bulls. Lord Krishna tied up the bulls, whose pride and strength were now broken, and pulled them with ropes, just as a child playfully pulls wooden toy bulls. Then King Nagnajit, pleased and astonished, presented his daughter to Lord Krishna. The Supreme Personality of Godhead accepted this suitable bride in the proper Vedic fashion. The king's wives felt the greatest ecstasy upon attaining Lord Krishna as the dear husband of the royal princess, and a mood of great festivity arose. Conch shells, horns, and drums resounded, along with vocal and instrumental music and the sounds of Brahmins invoking blessings. The joyful men and women adorned themselves with fine clothing and garlands. As the dowry, powerful King Nagnajit gave 10,000 cows, 3,000 young maidservants wearing golden ornaments on their necks and bedecked in fine clothing, 9,000 elephants, 100 times as many chariots as elephants, 100 times as many horses as chariots, and 100 times as many manservants as horses. The bride and groom mounted their chariot, surrounded by a great army. Then the king of Kosala, his heart melting with affection, sent them on their way. When the intolerant kings who had been rival suitors heard what had happened, they tried to stop Lord Krishna on the road as he took his bride home. But just as the bulls had broken their strength before, the Yadu warriors broke it now. Arjuna, wielder of the Gandiva bow, was always eager to please his friend Krishna, and thus he drove back those opponents who were shooting torrents of arrows at the Lord. He did this just as a lion drives away insignificant animals. Lord Krishna, the chief of the Yadus, then took his dowry and satya to Dwaraka and continued to live there happily. Bhadra was a princess of the Kaikeya kingdom and the daughter of Lord Krishna's paternal aunt, Shutakirti. The Lord married Bhadra when her brothers, headed by Santardhan, offered her to him. Then the Lord married Lakshmana, the daughter of the king of Madra. Krishna appeared alone at her Swayamvara ceremony and took her away, just as Garuda once stole the demigod's nectar. Lord Krishna also acquired thousands of other wives equal to these when he killed Bhaumasura and freed the beautiful maidens the demon was holding captive. Chapter 59, The Killing of the Demon Naraka. King Parikshit said, How was Bhaumasura, who kidnapped so many women, killed by the Supreme Lord? Please narrate this adventure of Lord Changadunbaz. Shukadeva Goswami said, After Bhauma had stolen the earrings belonging to Indra's mother, along with Varuna's umbrella and the demigod's playground at the peak of Mundara Mountain, Indra went to Lord Krishna and informed him of these misdeeds. The Lord, taking his wife Satyabhama with him, then rode on Garuda to Pragyotishapura, which was surrounded on all sides by fortifications consisting of hills, unmanned weapons, water, fire, and wind, and by obstructions of Murapasha wire. With his club, the Lord broke through the rock fortifications, with his arrows, the weapon fortifications, with his discs, the fire, water, and wind fortifications, and with his sword, the Murapasha cables. With the sound of his conch shell, Lord Gadadhar then shattered the magic seals of the fortress, along with the hearts of its brave defenders, and with his heavy club he demolished the surrounding earthen ramparts. The five-headed demon Mura, who slept at the bottom of the city's moat, awoke and rose up out of the water when he heard the vibration of Lord Krishna's Panchajanya conch shell. a sound as terrifying as the thunder at the end of the cosmic age. Shining with the blinding, terrible effulgence of the sun's fire at the end of a millennium, Mura seemed to be swallowing up the three worlds with his five mouths. He lifted up his trident and fell upon Garuda, the son of Tarksha, like an attacking snake. Mura whirled his trident and then hurled it fiercely at Garuda, roaring from all five mouths. The sound filled the earth and sky, all directions and the limits of outer space, until it reverberated against the very shell of the universe. Then with two arrows, Lord Hari struck the trident flying toward Garuda and broke it into three pieces. Next, the Lord hit Mura's faces with several arrows, and the demon angrily hurled his club at the Lord. As Mura's club sped toward him on the battlefield, Lord Krishna intercepted it with his own and broke it into thousands of pieces. Mura then raised his arms high and rushed at the unconquerable Lord, who easily sliced off his heads with his disc weapon. Lifeless, Mura's decapitated body fell into the water like a mountain whose peak has been severed by the power of Lord Indra's thunderbolt. The demon's seven sons, enraged by their father's death, prepared to retaliate. Ordered by Bhaumasura, Mura's seven sons, Tamra, Antariksha, Shravana, Vibhavasu, Vasu, Nibhasvan, and Aruna, followed their general Pita onto the battlefield bearing their weapons. These fierce warriors furiously attacked invincible Lord Krishna with arrows, swords, clubs, spears, lances, and tridents. But the Supreme Lord, with unfailing prowess, cut this mountain of weapons into tiny pieces with his arrows. The Lord severed the heads, thighs, arms, legs, and armor of these opponents led by Pita and sent them all to the abode of Yamaraj. Narakasura, the son of the earth, could not contain his fury when he saw the fate of his military leaders. Thus he went out of the citadel with elephants born from the milk ocean who were exuding mudda from their foreheads out of excitement. Lord Krishna and his wife, mounted upon Garuda, looked like a cloud with lightning sitting above the sun. Seeing the Lord, Bhoma released his Shatagni weapon at him, whereupon all of Bhoma's soldiers simultaneously attacked with their weapons. At that moment, Lord Krishna shot his sharp arrows at Bhaumasura's army. These arrows, displaying variegated feathers, soon reduced that army to a mass of bodies with severed arms, thighs, and necks. The Lord similarly killed the opposing horses and elephants. Lord Hari then struck down all the missiles and weapons the enemy soldiers threw at him, destroying each and every one with three sharp arrows. Meanwhile, Garuda, as he carried the Lord, struck the enemy's elephants with his wings. Beaten by Garuda's wings, beak, and talons, the elephants fled back into the city, leaving Narakasura alone on the battlefield to oppose Krishna. Seeing his army driven back and tormented by Garuda, Bhoma attacked him with his spear, which had once defeated Lord Indra's thunderbolt. But though struck by that mighty weapon, Garuda was not shaken. Indeed, he was like an elephant hit with a flower garland. Bhoma, frustrated in all his attempts, took up his trident to kill Lord Krishna. But even before he could release it, the Lord cut off his head with his razor-sharp chakra as the demon sat atop his elephant. Fallen on the ground, Bhaumasura's head shone brilliantly, decorated as it was with earrings and an attractive helmet. As cries of "Alas, alas!" and "Well done!" arose, the sages and principal demigods worshipped Lord Mukunda by showering him with flower garlands. The goddess of the earth then approached Lord Krishna and presented him with Aditi's earrings, which were made of glowing gold inlaid with shining jewels. She also gave him a Vaijayanti flower garland, Varuna's umbrella, and the peak of Mandara Mountain. After bowing down to him and then standing with joined palms, the goddess, her mind filled with devotion, began to praise the Lord of the universe, whom the best of demigods worship.
Bhumaruvacha Namaste Deva Devesha Shankha Chakra Gadadhara Bhakte Chopata Rupaya Bhadamatman Namostite Namak Pangaja Nabhaya Namak Pangaja Maline Namak Pangaja Netraya Namaste Pangajangraye Namo Bhagavate Tubhyam Vasudevaya Vishnave Purushayadi Bijaya Purnabodhaya Te Namaha. Jaya Janayatresya Brahmane Nanda Shaktahe Padavaratman Bhutatman Padamatman Namostute.
Goddess Bhumi said, "Obeisances unto you, O Lord of the chief demigods, O holder of the conch shell, disc, and club. O supreme soul within the heart, you assume your various forms to fulfill your devotees' desires. Obeisances unto you. My respectful obeisances are unto you, O Lord, whose abdomen is marked with a depression like a lotus flower, who are always decorated with garlands of lotus flowers, whose glance is as cool as the lotus, and whose feet are engraved with lotuses. Obeisances unto you, the supreme Lord Vasudev, Vishnu, the primeval person, the original seed. Obeisances unto you, the omniscient one. Obeisances unto you of unlimited energies, the unborn progenitor of this universe, the absolute. O soul of the high and the low, O soul of the created elements, O all-pervading supreme soul, obeisances unto you. Desiring to create, O unborn master, you increase and then assume the mode of passion. You do likewise with the mode of ignorance when you wish to annihilate the universe, and with goodness when you wish to maintain it. Nonetheless, you remain uncovered by these modes. You are time, the pradhan, and the purusha, O Lord of the universe, yet still you are separate and distinct. This is illusion, that earth, water, fire, air, ether, sense objects, demigods, mind, the senses, false ego, and the total material energy exist independent of you. In fact, they are all within you, my Lord, who are one without a second. Here is the son of Bhaumasura. Frightened, he is approaching your lotus feet, since you remove the distress of all who seek refuge in you. Please protect him. Place your lotus hand, which dispels all sins, upon his head." Shukadeva Goswami said, "Thus entreated by Goddess Bhumi in words of humble devotion, the Supreme Lord bestowed fearlessness upon her grandson, and then entered Bhaumasura's palace, which was filled with all manner of riches. There Lord Krishna saw 16,000 royal maidens, whom Bhauma had taken by force from various kings. The women became enchanted when they saw that most excellent of males enter. In their minds they accepted him, who had been brought there by destiny, as their chosen husband. With the thought, 'May providence grant that this man become my husband,' each and every princess absorbed her heart in contemplation of Krishna. The Lord had the princesses arrayed in clean, spotless garments, and then sent them in palanquins to Dwaraka, together with great treasures of chariots, horses, and other valuables. Lord Krishna also dispatched 64 swift white elephants, descendants of Airavata, who each sported 4 tusks. The Lord then went to the abode of Indra, the demigod's king, and gave Mother Aditi her earrings. There Indra and his wife worshipped Krishna and his beloved consort Satyabhama. Then, at Satyabhama's behest, the Lord uprooted the heavenly Parijata tree and put it on the back of Garuda. After defeating Indra and all the other demigods, Krishna brought the Parijata to his capital. Once planted, the Parijata tree beautified the garden of Queen Satyabhama's palace. Bees followed the tree all the way from heaven, greedy for its fragrance and sweet sap. Even after Indra had bowed down to Lord Achyuta, touched his feet with the tips of his crown, and begged the Lord to fulfill his desire, that exalted demigod, having achieved his purpose, chose to fight with the Supreme Lord. What ignorance there is among the gods! To hell with their opulence! Then the imperishable Supreme Personality, assuming a separate form for each bride, duly married all the princesses simultaneously, each in her own palace. The Lord, performer of the inconceivable, constantly remained in each of his queen's palaces, which were unequaled and unexcelled by any other residence. There, although fully satisfied within himself, he enjoyed with his pleasing wives, and, like an ordinary husband, he carried out his household duties. Thus those women obtained as their husband the husband of the goddess of fortune, although even great demigods like Brahma do not know how to approach him. With ever-increasing pleasure, they experienced loving attraction for him, exchanged smiling glances with him, and reciprocated with him in ever-fresh intimacy, replete with joking and feminine shyness. Although the Supreme Lord's queens each had hundreds of maidservants, They chose to personally serve the Lord by approaching him humbly, offering him a seat, worshiping him with excellent paraphernalia, bathing and massaging his feet, giving him pan to chew, fanning him, anointing him with fragrant sandalwood paste, adorning him with flower garlands, dressing his hair, arranging his bed, bathing him, and presenting him with various gifts. Chapter 60. Krishna teases Rukmini. Sri Badarayani said, "Once, in the company of her maidservants, Queen Rukmini was personally serving her husband, the spiritual master of the universe, by fanning him as he relaxed on her bed. The unborn personality of Godhead, the supreme controller, who creates, maintains, and then devours this universe simply as his play, took birth among the Yadus to preserve his own laws. Queen Rukmini's quarters were extremely beautiful, boasting a canopy hung with brilliant strings of pearls, as well as effulgent jewels serving as lamps. Garlands of jasmine and other flowers hung here and there, attracting swarms of humming bees, and the spotless rays of the moon shone through the holes of the lattice windows. As a guru incense drifted out of the window holes, the breeze wafting the scent of the Parijata grove carried the mood of a garden into the room. There the queen served her husband, the supreme lord of all the worlds, as he reclined upon an opulent pillow on her bed, which was as soft and white as the foam of milk. From her maidservant's hand, Goddess Rukmini took a yak hair fan with a jeweled handle, and then she began to worship her master by fanning him. Her hand adorned with rings, bangles, and the chamara fan, Queen Rukmini looked resplendent standing near Lord Krishna. Her jeweled ankle bells tinkled, and her necklace glittered, reddened by the kumkum from her breasts, which were covered by the end of her sari. On her hips, she wore a priceless belt. As he contemplated her, the goddess of fortune herself, who desires only him, Lord Krishna smiled. The Lord assumes various forms to enact his pastimes, and he was pleased that the form the goddess of fortune had assumed was just suitable for her to serve as his consort. Her charming face was adorned with curling hair, earrings, a locket on her neck, and the nectar of her bright, happy smile. The Lord then spoke to her as follows. "My dear princess, you were sought after by many kings as powerful as the rulers of planets. They were all abundantly endowed with political influence, wealth, beauty, generosity, and physical strength. Since your brother and father offered you to them, why did you reject the king of Chedi and all those other suitors who stood before you maddened by Cupid? Why, instead, did you choose us, who are not at all your equal? Terrified of these kings, O lovely-browed one, we took shelter in the ocean. We have become enemies of powerful men, and we practically abandoned our royal throne. O fine-browed lady, women are usually destined to suffer when they stay with men whose behavior is uncertain and who pursue a path not approved by society. We have no material possessions, and we are dear to those who similarly have nothing. Therefore, O slender one, the wealthy hardly ever worship me. Marriage and friendship are proper between two people who are equal in terms of their wealth, birth, influence, physical appearance, and capacity for a good progeny, but never between a superior and an inferior. O Vaidarbhi, not being far-sighted, you didn't realize this, and therefore you chose us as your husband, even though we have no good qualities and are glorified only by deluded beggars. Now you should definitely accept a more suitable husband, a first-class man of the royal order who can help you achieve everything you want, both in this life and the next. Kings like Shishupal, Shalva, Jarasand, and Dantavakra all hate me, O beautiful thighed one, and so does your elder brother Rukmi. It was to dispel the arrogance of these kings that I carried you away, my good woman, for they were blinded by the intoxication of power. My purpose was to curb the strength of the wicked. We care nothing for wives, children, and wealth. Always satisfied within ourselves, we do not work for body and home, but like a light, we merely witness." Shukadeva Goswami said, "Rukmini had thought herself especially beloved by the Lord, because he never left her company. By saying these things to her, he vanquished her pride, and then he stopped speaking. Goddess Rukmini had never before heard such unpleasantries from her beloved, the Lord of universal rulers, and she became frightened. A tremor arose in her heart, and in terrible anxiety she began to cry. With her tender foot, effulgent with the reddish glow of her nails, she scratched the ground, and tears darkened by her eye makeup sprinkled her kumkum-reddened breasts. There she stood, face downward, her voice choked up by extreme sorrow. Rukmini's mind was overwhelmed with unhappiness, fear, and grief. Her bangle slipped from her hand, and her fan fell to the ground. In her bewilderment, she suddenly fainted, her hair scattering all about as her body fell to the ground like a plantain tree blown over by the wind. Seeing that his beloved was so bound to him in love that she could not understand the full meaning of his teasing, merciful Lord Krishna felt compassion for her. The Lord quickly got down from the bed. Manifesting four arms, he picked her up, gathered her hair, and caressed her face with his lotus hand. Wiping her tear-filled eyes and her breasts, which were stained by tears of grief, the Supreme Lord, the goal of his devotees, embraced his chaste wife, who desired nothing but him, O King. Expert in the art of pacification, Sri Krishna tenderly consoled pitiable Rukmini, whose mind was bewildered by his clever joking, and who did not deserve to suffer so. The Supreme Lord said, O Vaidarbhi, do not be displeased with me. I know that you are fully devoted to me. I only spoke in jest, dear lady, because I wanted to hear what you would say. I also wanted to see your face with lips trembling in loving anger, the reddish corners of your eyes throwing sidelong glances, and the line of your beautiful eyebrows knit in a frown. The greatest pleasure worldly householders can enjoy at home is to spend time joking with their beloved wives, my dear timid and temperamental one. Shukadev Goswami said, O King, Queen Vaidarbhi was fully pacified by the Supreme Personality of Godhead and understood that his words had been spoken in jest. Thus she gave up her fear that her beloved would reject her. Smiling bashfully as she cast charming, affectionate glances upon the face of the Lord, the best of males, Rukmini spoke the following, O descendant of Bharat. Sri Rukmini Vacha Nandeva Metadada Vindavalochanaha Yadvaim Bhavan Bhagavato Sadrishi Vibhumna Kvasse Mahimya Bidito Bhagavan Stradisha Kvahanguna Pakitiragya Guhita Pada Satyam Bayadi Bhagune Bihuruk Kramanta Sheti Samundra Upalambhana Matra Atma Nityam Kat Indra Yaganai Kutavingrahastam Tvatseva Karnipapadam Vidutam Tamondham Vatpada Padna Makadanda Dusham Muninam Vataspatam Nipashubi Nanudu Vibhavyam Yasmada Laukikami Vehitam Isharasya Bhumamsta Vehitamato Hanuye Bhavantam. Sri Rukmini said, Actually, what you have said is true, O lotus-eyed one. I am indeed unsuitable for the almighty personality of Godhead. What comparison is there between that Supreme Lord, who is master of the three primal deities and who delights in his own glory, and myself, a woman of mundane qualities whose feet are grasped by fools? Yes, my Lord Urukram, you lay down within the ocean as if afraid of the material modes, and thus in pure consciousness you appear within the heart as the Supersoul. You are always battling against the foolish material senses, and indeed even your servants reject the privilege of royal dominion, which leads to the blindness of ignorance. Your movements, inscrutable even for sages who relish the honey of your lotus feet, are certainly incomprehensible for human beings who behave like animals. And just as your activities are transcendental, O all-powerful Lord, so too are those of your followers. You possess nothing because there is nothing beyond you. Even the great enjoyers of tribute, Brahma and other demigods, pay tribute to you. Those who are blinded by their wealth and absorbed in gratifying their senses do not recognize you in the form of death. But to the gods, the enjoyers of tribute, you are the most dear as they are to you. You are the embodiment of all human goals and are yourself the final aim of life. Desiring to attain you, O all-powerful Lord, intelligent persons abandon everything else. It is they who are worthy of your association, not men and women absorbed in the pleasure and grief resulting from their mutual lust. Knowing that great sages who have renounced the sannyasi's danda proclaim your glories, that you are the supreme soul of all the worlds, and that you are so gracious that you give away even your own self, I chose you as my husband, rejecting Lord Brahma, Lord Shiva, and the rulers of heaven, whose aspirations are all frustrated by the force of time, which is born from your eyebrows. What interest, then, could I have in any other suitors? My lord, as a lion drives away lesser animals to claim his proper tribute, you drove away the assembled kings with the resounding twang of your shanga bow, and then claimed me, your fair share. Thus it is sheer foolishness, my dear Gadagwaja, for you to say you took shelter in the ocean out of fear of those kings. Wanting your association, the best of kings, Anga, Vainya, Jayanta, Nahusha, Gaya, and others, abandoned their absolute sovereignty and entered the forest to seek you out. How could those kings suffer frustration in this world, O lotus-eyed one? The aroma of your lotus feet, which is glorified by great saints, awards people liberation and is the abode of Goddess Lakshmi. What woman would take shelter of any other man after savoring that aroma? Since you are the abode of transcendental qualities, what mortal woman with the insight to distinguish her own true interest would disregard that fragrance and depend instead on someone who is always subject to terrible fear? Because you are suitable for me, I have chosen you, the master and supreme soul of all the worlds, who fulfill our desires in this life and the next. May your feet, which give freedom from illusion by approaching their worshipper, give shelter to me, who have been wandering from one material situation to another. O infallible Krishna, let each of the kings you named become the husband of a woman whose ears have never heard your glories, which are sung in the assemblies of Shiva and Brahma. After all, in the households of such women, these kings live like asses, oxen, dogs, cats, and slaves. A woman who fails to relish the fragrance of the honey of your lotus feet becomes totally befooled, and thus she accepts as her husband or lover a living corpse covered with skin, whiskers, nails, head hair, and body hair, and filled with flesh, bones, blood, parasites, feces, mucus, bile, and air. O lotus-eyed one, though you are satisfied within yourself and thus rarely turn your attention toward me, please bless me with steady love for your feet. It is when you assume a predominance of passion in order to manifest the universe that you glance upon me, showing me what is indeed your greatest mercy. Actually, I don't consider your words false, Madhusudan. Quite often an unmarried girl is attracted to a man, as in the case of Amba. The mind of a promiscuous woman always hankers for new lovers, even if she is married. An intelligent man should not keep such an unchaste wife, for if he does, he will lose his good fortune both in this life and the next. The Supreme Lord said, O saintly lady, O princess, we deceived you only because we wanted to hear you speak like this. Indeed, everything you said in reply to my words is most certainly true. Whatever benedictions you hope for in order to become free of material desires are ever yours, O fair and noble lady, for you are my unalloyed devotee. O sinless one, I have now seen firsthand the pure love and chaste attachment you have for your husband. Even though shaken by my words, your mind could not be pulled away from me. Although I have the power to award spiritual liberation, lusty persons worship me with penance and vows in order to get my blessings for their mundane family life. Such persons are bewildered by my illusory energy. O supreme reservoir of love, unfortunate are they who, even after obtaining me, the Lord of both liberation and material riches, hanker only for material treasures. These worldly gains can be found even in hell. Since such persons are obsessed with sense gratification, hell is a fitting place for them. Fortunately, O mistress of the house, you have always rendered me faithful devotional service, which liberates one from material existence. This service is very difficult for the envious to perform, especially for a woman whose intentions are wicked, who lives only to gratify her bodily demands, and who indulges in duplicity. In all my palaces, I can find no other wife as loving as you, O most respectful one. When you were to be married, you disregarded all the kings who had assembled to seek your hand, and simply because you had heard authentic accounts concerning me, you sent a Brahmin to me with your confidential message. When your brother, who had been defeated in battle and then disfigured, was later killed during a gambling match on Aniruddha's wedding day, you felt unbearable grief. Yet out of fear of losing me, you spoke not a word. By this silence, you have conquered me. When you sent the messenger with your most confidential plan, and yet I delayed going to you, you began to see the whole world as void and wanted to quit your body, which could never have been given to anyone but me. May this greatness of yours remain with you always. I can do nothing to reciprocate except joyfully thank you for your devotion. Shukadev Goswami said, And so the self-satisfied Supreme Lord of the universe enjoyed with the goddess of fortune, engaging her in lovers' talks and thus imitating the ways of human society. The Almighty Lord Hari, preceptor of all the worlds, similarly behaved like a conventional householder in the palaces of his other queens, performing the religious duties of a family man. Chapter 61. Lord Balaram Slays Rukmi. Shukadev Goswami said, Each of Lord Krishna's wives gave birth to 10 sons, who were not less than their father, having all his personal opulence. Because each of these princesses saw that Lord Achyuta never left her palace, each thought herself the Lord's favorite. These women did not understand the full truth about him. The Supreme Lord's wives were fully enchanted by his lovely lotus-like face, his long arms and large eyes, his loving glances imbued with laughter, and his charming talks with them. But with all their charms, these ladies could not conquer the mind of the all-powerful Lord. The arched eyebrows of these 16,000 queens enchantingly expressed those ladies' secret intentions through coyly smiling sidelong glances. Thus their eyebrows boldly sent forth conjugal messages. Yet even with these arrows of Cupid, and with other means as well, they could not agitate Lord Krishna's senses. Thus these women obtained as their husband the master of the goddess of fortune, although even great demigods like Brahma do not know how to approach him. With ever-increasing pleasure, they felt loving attraction for him, exchanged smiling glances with him, eagerly anticipated associating with him in ever-fresh intimacy, and enjoyed in many other ways. Although the Supreme Lord's queens each had hundreds of maidservants, they chose to personally serve the Lord by approaching him humbly, offering him a seat, worshipping him with excellent paraphernalia, bathing and massaging his feet, giving him pan to chew, fanning him, anointing him with fragrant sandalwood paste, adorning him with flower garlands, dressing his hair, arranging his bed, bathing him, and presenting him with various gifts. Among Lord Krishna's wives, each of whom had 10 sons, I previously mentioned 8 principal queens. I shall now recite for you the names of those 8 queens' sons, headed by Pradyumna. The first son of Queen Rukmini was Pradyumna, and also born of her were Charudeshna, Sudeshna, and the powerful Charudeha, along with Sucharu, Charugupta, Bhadracharu, Charuchandra, Vicharu, and Charu the 10th. None of these sons of Lord Hari was less than his father. The 10 sons of Satyabhama were Banu, Subhanu, Swarbhanu, Prabhanu, Banuman, Chandrabhanu, Brihadbhanu, Atibhanu the 8th, Sribhanu, and Patibhanu. Samba, Sumitra, Purujit, Shatajit, Sahasrajit, Vijay, Chitraketu, Vasuman, Dravida, and Kratu were the sons of Jambavati. These 10, headed by Samba, were their father's favorites. The sons of Nagmajiti were Vira, Chandra, Ashvasen, Chitragu, Vegavan, Vrisha, Ama, Shanku, Vasu, and the opulent Kunti. Shruta, Kavi, Vrisha, Vira, Subahu, Bhadra, Shanti, Darsha, and Purnamasa were sons of Kalindi. Her youngest son was Somaka. Madra's sons were Pragosh, Gatravan, Singha, Bala, Prabala, Urdhaga, Mahashakti, Saha, Oja, and Aparajita. Mitravinda's sons were Vrika, Harsha, Anila, Gridra, Vardhana, Unnada, Mahansa, Pavana, Vanni, and Shuddhi. Sangramajit, Brihatsen, Shura, Paharana, Arajit, Jai, and Subhadra were the sons of Bhadra, together with Vama, Ayur, and Satyaka. Deeptiman, Tamratapta, and others were the sons of Lord Krishna and Rohini. Lord Krishna's son Prajumna fathered the greatly powerful Aniruddha in the womb of Rukmavati, the daughter of Rukmi. O King, this took place while they were living in the city of Bhojakata. My dear King, the sons and grandsons of Lord Krishna's children numbered in the tens of millions. 16,000 mothers gave rise to this dynasty. King Parikshit said, how could Rukmi give his daughter to his enemy's son? After all, Rukmi had been defeated by Lord Krishna in battle and was waiting for an opportunity to kill him. Please explain this to me, O learned one, how these two inimical parties became united through marriage. Mystic yogis can perfectly see that which has not yet happened, as well as things in the past or present, beyond the senses, remote or blocked by physical obstacles. Sri Shukadeva Goswami said, at her Swayamvara ceremony, Rukmavati herself chose Prajumna, who was the re-embodiment of Cupid. Then, although he fought alone on a single chariot, Prajumna defeated the assembled kings in battle and took her away. Though Rukmi always remembered his enmity toward Lord Krishna, who had insulted him, in order to please his sister, he sanctioned his daughter's marriage to his nephew. Bali, the son of Kritavarma, married Rukmini's young daughter, large-eyed Charumati. Rukmi gave his granddaughter, Rochana, to his daughter's son, Aniruddha, despite Rukmi's relentless feud with Lord Hari. Although Rukmi considered this marriage irreligious, he wanted to please his sister, bound as he was by the ropes of affection. On the joyous occasion of that marriage, O King, Queen Rukmini, Lord Balaram, Lord Krishna, and several of the Lord's sons, headed by Samba and Prajumna, went to the city of Bhojakata. After the wedding, a group of arrogant kings headed by the king of Kalinga told Rukmi, you should defeat Balaram at dice. He's not expert at dice, O King, but still he's quite addicted to it. Thus advised, Rukmi challenged Balaram and began a gambling match with him. In that match, Lord Balaram first accepted a wager of 100 coins, then 1,000, then 10,000. Rukmi won this first round, and the king of Kalinga laughed loudly at Lord Balaram, showing all his teeth. Lord Balaram could not tolerate this. Next, Rukmi accepted a bet of 100,000 coins, which Lord Balaram won. But Rukmi tried to cheat, declaring, I'm the winner! Shaking with anger like the ocean on the full moon day, handsome Lord Balaram, his naturally reddish eyes even redder in his fury, accepted a wager of 100 million gold coins. Lord Balaram fairly won this wager also, but Rukmi again resorted to cheating and declared, I have won! Let these witnesses here say what they saw! Just then a voice from the sky declared, Balaram has fairly won this wager. Rukmi is surely lying. Urged on by the wicked kings, Rukmi ignored the divine voice. In fact, destiny itself was urging Rukmi on, and thus he ridiculed Lord Balaram as follows. You cowherds who wander about the forest know nothing about dice. Playing with dice and sporting with arrows are only for kings, not for the likes of you. Thus insulted by Rukmi and ridiculed by the kings, Lord Balaram was provoked to anger. In the midst of the auspicious wedding assembly, he raised his club and struck Rukmi dead. The king of Kalinga, who had laughed at Lord Balaram and shown his teeth, tried to run away, but the furious lord quickly seized him on his tenth step and knocked out all his teeth. Tormented by Lord Balaram's club, the other kings fled in fear, their arms, thighs, and heads broken, and their bodies drenched in blood. When his brother-in-law Rukmi was slain, Lord Krishna neither applauded nor protested, O King, for he feared jeopardizing his affectionate ties with either Rukmini or Balaram. Then the descendants of the Sharha, headed by Lord Balaram, seated Aniruddha and his bride on a fine chariot and set off from Bhojakata for Dwaraka. Having taken shelter of Lord Madhusudan, they had fulfilled all their purposes. Chapter 62, The Meeting of Usha and Aniruddha. King Parikshit said, the best of the Yadus married Banasura's daughter, Usha, and as a result, a great, fearsome battle occurred between Lord Hari and Lord Shankara. Please explain everything about this incident, O most powerful of mystics. Shukadeva Goswami said, Bana was the oldest of the 100 sons fathered by the great saint Bali Maharaj, who gave the whole earth in charity to Lord Hari when he appeared as Vamanadev. Banasura, born from Bali's semen, became a great devotee of Lord Shiva. His behavior was always respectable, and he was generous, intelligent, truthful, and firm in his vows. The beautiful city of Shonitapur was under his dominion. Because Lord Shiva had favored him, the demigods waited on Banasura like menial servants. Once, when Shiva was dancing his Tandava Nritya, Bana especially satisfied the Lord by playing a musical accompaniment with his 1,000 arms. The Lord and Master of all created beings, the compassionate refuge of his devotees, gladdened Banasura by offering him the benediction of his choice. Bana chose to have him, Lord Shiva, as the guardian of his city. Banasura was intoxicated with his strength. One day, when Lord Shiva was standing beside him, Banasura touched the Lord's lotus feet with his helmet, which shone like the sun, and spoke to him as follows.